Welcome to OnkLive On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. OnkLive On Air is a podcast from OnkLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OnkLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode of How This Is Building Me, which was recorded in person during the 2023 IASLC World Conference on Lung Cancer, host D. Ross Kamage, MD, PhD, of the University of Colorado, sits down with Edward B. Guerin, MD, MS, a professor of medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Medicine. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Kamage and Guerin discuss the importance of continuing to ask a variety of research questions throughout one's career, the value of negative study results, and the ins and outs of running the lung cancer program and conducting phase 3 trials at UCLA.
Hello, I'm Ross Kamage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And I am thrilled to have with me someone I've wanted to have as a guest for quite some time, Eddie Guerin. So, Eddie, would you like to introduce yourself in any way you think is appropriate?
Eddie Guerin, and I am at UCLA, and I'm a medical oncologist.
That's doing yourself some disservice. You're like some super medical oncologist, aren't you? So, do you have a rank?
So I am. I'm a professor of medicine at UCLA. I run the thoracic oncology division, and I am a director of the Signal Transduction and Therapeutics Unit, which you'll probably laugh about because I remember one time being on a call with you with a bunch of people who wanted sort of to assess where things were in lung cancer. And there was a targeted therapy question, and I started answering, and they wanted to make it very clear that, in fact, Dr. Guerin, you are not here to answer a targeted therapy question. That's why we have Dr. Camp.
I remember that. So hold on. So your target therapy, ugemafilipid, does it have a cute acronym? That's quite a long title.
Signal Transduction Therapeutics, STT.
STT?
Is the program area.
And you're also the director of thoracic oncology?
Correct.
So our careers have kind of overlapped to a certain extent. I remember meeting you on a bus at ASCO, and I think we were both trying to have kids at the same time, and for some reason we bonded over that. And then I have watched your career.
Not together.
Not yet. No. It never worked. We had to have... We had to go our separate ways. But I've kind of watched your career grow. And the beautiful thing is that I've never competed with you, partly because, you know, I could never compete with you, but also because we managed to go in different areas. So looking back over your career, which is now 15, close to 20 years, define yourself. What are you an expert in?
It's an excellent question. I still keep asking myself. And one of the things that actually really that I love about what I do is that I can keep asking questions in different areas. And it has changed over time and continues to change. But it's not always changing. It's sort of modifying what you're doing and taking it in a slightly different direction. Originally, as you point out, we were doing a lot of the same things with some of the novel targeted therapy approaches. And then things changed a lot for me when I got involved in the original pembrolizumab war. And then from sort of the perspective of what are my grants in and things like that, it's really predictive biomarkers for immunotherapy. And so that would be what I consider my expertise, not as a pathologist, because I'm not a pathologist, but from the medical oncology front.
Now, you told me earlier that you started off life trying to decide if you wanted to be some kind of a basic scientist rather than a clinician. So can you go through that?
Sure. Now, it's always sort of funny because I sort of bounced around early in, you know, about whether I wanted to be a physician or a scientist. And for the people who are sort of in their training right now, this may seem bizarre, but there were totally different things when we were sort of coming up through undergrad and things like that. The people who were physicians were taking care of patients in the clinic, and the people who were scientists had a laboratory, and there really wasn't much in between. And so I always joke that I would follow along with a doctor, you know, friends of my parents or things like that. And at the end of the day, they'd say, oh, you ask good questions. You seem very smart, but you're clearly a lab guy.
And this is like when you're in high school.
Yeah. Okay. When I was in like high school. And then, you know, when I would go to a lab, you know, they say, you're doing fine. Your questions are good, things like that. But I think you're more
want, like, nobody wanted you?
School. Yeah, exactly. And so, I kept sort of bouncing between those. And in fact, I did my undergrad at MIT. I sort of convinced myself that I was going to be a laboratory scientist. And then sort of midway through my junior year, I'm like, I just don't think I can be like a laboratory scientist. It's a little isolating. And so at that point, I decided to go to medical school. And one of the fortunate things, because our coursework was so heavy on science, when I went, they like set me up with an advisor because they had no medical school. So now they have something with Harvard, but they had no medical school. So they set me up with the person who led their OBGYN group at the student health, their med school advisor. And we went through what prerequisites I needed. And I needed one additional English class.
Oh, that's old.
To go to medical school. So awesome. I was able to go straight from undergrad to medical school.
But then even when you go through medical school and, you know, you sort of go through this, there's still a lot of science in medicine. So were you ever tempted to become a clinician scientist?
To me at the time, there were two very different things. It was completely separate. And so that never felt to me like an option to do science that wasn't like starting up your own wet lab.
Yeah.
At the time. That's sort of where I am now.
Yeah.
But that never felt like an option when I was trained.
We'll get to that, but then you seem to be a sort of late starter in terms of, you know, having your own lab.
That's what they always told me growing up, I'd be a late bloomer.
So one of the things, I think when I first met you, you were kind of like one of Dennis Slamon's kind of babies, weren't you? So Dennis Slamon, the guy who discovered Herceptin, you know, big presence at UCLA. And then was there someone running the lung cancer program before you? Or?
So when I came out of fellowship, I didn't have any huge expertise. I'd done a lot of work in a laboratory that had done lymphoma work.
Okay.
And initially, I actually pitched myself that I would do low-grade lymphoma and pancreatic cancer. That was what I was hired to do at UCLA. There were basically, at the time, two rival lung cancers.
At UCLA?
At UCLA. Like, okay. And when I say rival, if they saw each other in the lunchroom, they went the other way.
Oh, wow.
And so one of the people who had worked closely with Dr. Slamon left. And so I emailed him and said, look, I don't have any expertise in any. I just finished my fellowship. If you have a better place for me, I'm happy to do it. He said, okay, fine, you're the lung cancer guy.
So you dropped the lymphoma?
Correct. And you may ask why I dropped the
low-grade lymphoma. Yeah, there's too much good news in your life. You know, I want lung cancer and what was it, pancreatic cancer?
For several years, I did lung cancer and pancreatic cancer.
Wow.
And so basically all the people who had been doing lung cancer within like probably 6 months of me being there all basically left. And so all of a sudden, I had a huge clinical load.
Did they leave for other reasons, or were they looking to, you know, just dump?
Yeah,
you're so unpleasant. They had to leave. No. Was it kind of like they're desperate to get rid of lung cancer as an unattractive specialty?
No, in fact, it wasn't one person left for personal reasons. That's the person I sort of took over for. And the other people actually left because of a better opportunity.
Okay.
So they had very good opportunities outside. And so then all of a sudden, I'm like 6 months into my training, and all the other people were largely gone.
Yeah. So it's funny. This is really a recurrent theme of people suddenly having kind of leadership roles forced upon them. I know there are people out there who go and seek them, but there are many people it's just thrust upon them and they just have to run with it. Were you okay with that? Or is it at any point you go, I need to go somewhere else?
Well, the way it played out, it didn't really feel like a leadership role.
Because you're leading yourself.
There was no one else. They did have someone senior who was supervising me. So I wasn't even actually leading the group, but I functionally was the only person who was doing a lot in lung cancer. At the time, I didn't have a lot of like clinical trials or anything like that. I just had a busy clinic.
Yeah.
All of the other lung cancer people had left.
So how did you build clinical trial?
So I sort of did things exactly the way they told you you're never supposed to. They always sort of talk about it. You're supposed to have, you know, come into the situation where you have 80% protected time, and then you build up, you know, sort of your lab or whatever, and then sort of go take that into clinical trials. And I sort of did it the other way, in the sense that all of a sudden I was very clinically busy and seeing a lot of patients. And once I was clinically busy, I became an attractive site for clinical trials. And
did people reach out to you, or were you reaching out to them?
to be honest, I probably found her for a long time. And you mentioned before that we sort of worked together early in our career, and I think we had our first paper together back in 2011.
Yeah.
But I've been at faculty for 5 years, and that was my first, I think, clinical paper at that point. So at first, I just needed to see a lot of patients. I wasn't the one to get credit for any of the clinical trials we had. The senior person had the trials. I was seeing the patients. So it really was not the way sort of one would typically design it. But over time, you know, I was able to put patients on trials. So when I was able to put patients on trials, one of the other things that was helpful for them, particularly with sort of a translational interest, was I was able to make specimens from those people who were on trials. And so that became a significant interest of mine, is sort of biomarker work and trying to use the fact that at least I saw these patients on trials with novel therapies, I could make their specimens.
So looking through your CV, which is always fun to kind of go through the kind of, you know, dirty laundry of somebody that appears on their CV, I saw that one of your early grants was with DCA, dichloroacetate, which is one of these kind of like alternative drugs that's been floated. So first of all, how did you hit on, you know, going in that direction? Secondly, did it work?
You sold this to me that I would be able to go through my greatest hits album.
Yeah, yeah. We're starting off with some of the stuff that didn't make it to the greatest hits.
So the DCA trial actually was a particularly interesting study. So as you point out, DCA is sort of an internet darling.
It's like ivermectin.
Yeah. The one thing I would say,
and it is not endorsed by a president
versus ivermectin, is there is some reasonably good preclinical work that supports the idea of DCA, which also stands for dichloroacetate. It's actually an approved therapy for some like inborn metabolic disorders, but it plays very nicely into this story of pharma's trying to kill you because they can't make money on it. And so the issue is because it's basically an approved drug, it would be very difficult to get appropriate IP protection for it. And so the way the sort of story on the internet goes is that as a result, you know, that because there's no profit to be made, this is a great cure for cancer that nobody's developed.
Yeah, and we're all sitting on the cure and not telling anyone about it.
Correct. And so there was a patient that I had that I acquired when everyone left that was of significant means, and they were interested. They'd gotten enthused about dichloroacetate or DCA from all the buzz that was on the internet about it. So of course, with sort of my scientific bent, I explained to them, you know, that the problem is that we don't really have appropriate data, and that if one did want to develop a drug like this, that here are the appropriate steps one would need to take. And so they said, fine. When you do that?
Okay.
And they said, how much would it cost? And so
this is a very Californian way of being.
It was also particularly interesting because they were very close with an even wealthier person that the dean was very interested in at the time.
Okay.
And so that was another very sort of funny situation because I'm like 6 months on the faculty. The dean of the medical school was basically paging me every few days about this. So we did put together a proposal for the grant. We did run both the clinical study and we did some preclinical work on it.
Where did you get the DCA? Did you just order it off the internet?
Yeah, we just bought it. And in fact, it's the only study I've ever had. And you buy it, it's like a big powder. And so it's sort of funny, but you had to go through like with the investigational pharmacy how that works. But they were able to do it in the context of a clinical
trial. Did you compound it into a tablet or you just dissolved it in water or something?
My recollection, and it's because it's been a little while, but my recollection is that we dissolved it in water.
Okay.
And but we had it, we bought it.
Yeah.
And we had it stored by the investigational pharmacist and we were able to make it work. But unfortunately, some of the patients did not have great outcomes. And actually, the DSMB actually closed it down. Our institutional DSMB, based on the sort of risk benefits analysis after several of the patients. And so we published the results, or at least feel good about that, that we published it.
How many patients did you treat? Do you remember?
I'm trying to remember. I think it was around 10.
It wasn't a
new number before.
And the outcome was response rate?
We were looking for response rate, and the toxicity profile that we saw was significant.
Oh, because they pitch it as this kind of benign sort of...
So that's not entirely true, and there are neurologic complications, and it's been a little while because, you know, time has elapsed, but because I had a clinical trial that was searchable on clinicaltrials.gov, it was, in fact, not uncommon that I would get a call from an ER somewhere in the country of somebody who came in with a neurologic problem after taking it. One of the other problems is because it came as a powder.
Yeah.
And so now you're counting on individuals that are going to oftentimes get their medical advice from the internet.
Yeah.
And making the decisions about their own health. So you can buy it.
Yeah.
And then you can give yourself as much as you want.
Yeah.
So that was often the calls that would come in from an outside ER with someone with significant neuropathy who had said, well, if, you know, or if this much is good, 10 times as much must be 10 times better because it's quite benign. And that was a call I got not infrequently. It's sort of not exactly part of one's job description.
Yeah, being the expert on DCA toxicity, I had no idea that, you know, the greatest I was speaking to.
Yeah.
Actually, before I get to your greatest hits, I do want to just drag one other thing up from the depths, which is the pembrolizumab given to EGFR mutant lung cancer. So to explain, you know, this is immunotherapy where there was a period of time and everyone was excited about it. And, you know, there was this statement that it was like chocolate. Everything tasted better if it was immunotherapy was added in, like chocolate was added into something. And so just explain the kind of genesis of that trial and also when you realized that this wasn't a great idea.
Sure. So interestingly, the when I realized it wasn't a great idea was very clear. And so I essentially described this to my trainees, and this is actually true, is that in the end, the worst clinical trial is one that you get to the end and you don't know how to interpret it.
Yeah.
And so the lesson from this trial was that it's best to have a really good hypothesis, but to have an hypothesis that's so atrocious that you basically disprove it convincingly is of some value.
Yeah.
And actually, I would argue that this study was of significant value because this was a very common question among practitioners and somebody who particularly had high PD-L1 expression and an EGFR mutation.
Yeah.
Should they be getting pembrolizumab or should they be getting an EGFR inhibitor? So we had basically at one point nearly the entire world's experience of treatment naive or EGFR inhibitor naive, EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer receiving pembrolizumab. Just from a quirk of the way the studies were written, we had four patients that were able to, without any protocol violations or deviations or anything like that, get on the pembrolizumab study. And of that, two of the four were responders. And this was a group of people that we were not able to make meaningful benefit with PD-1 inhibitors otherwise. And so it led to this theory, just sort of mining the data of a small number of people, that this would be a good approach. And so we ran what was going to be a small pilot study, which I thought was appropriate. We had this sort of not particularly well-defined hypothesis based on observational data of something that people want. And I think that that's something that does get lost. And, you know, obviously we have a lot of EGFR, both have a lot of EGFR mutation positive patients in our clinic. And, you know, we tell them about how great these new drugs are. But if you're 32 years old, the fact that, you know, that osimertinib is likely to lead to 3 years or more of survival, it doesn't really do it for you.
No.
We, in fact, had no problem as a single site enrolling about a patient a month for this study. And this was largely for people who had high PD-L1 expression. You had to at least have some PD-L1 expression, but most of the people we enrolled had high PD-L1 expression.
So the first question is, didn't the IRB, the Institutional Review Board, come at you and say, look, you have zero data that's worked, you're going to try it, and there's an approved therapy, how can this be a first-line trial?
The IRB or the Institutional Review Board didn't write us back afterwards and say, this sounds like a great idea, go ahead. They had questions, but even up front, we had written the consent form to be extraordinarily clear. In the consent, even when we originally submitted it, we said, you know, we do not believe you are more likely to have a response to the pembrolizumab than to the EGFR inhibitor. And the idea was to have that over the long term, you would have a group of patients who derived long-term benefit from the pembrolizumab, and that would offset, you know, the fact the response rate was lower. And since we were, of course, very confident that there wouldn't be any problem with giving an EGFR inhibitor after pembrolizumab, we said, what's the harm? You'll just salvage all the people with an EGFR inhibitor afterwards. There was, at the time, absolutely zero data to indicate that giving an EGFR inhibitor before chemotherapy led to a survival improvement.
Yeah.
And so although the IRB, you know, wasn't initially thrilled with the idea, we were able to provide data and put together a consent form that convinced them that this was an appropriate scientific question and that the statements that we made in the consent form were clear enough to a patient that they could make an informed decision as to whether or not they wanted to participate.
Was the first scan still at like 6 weeks or 8 weeks, or did you do an early scan because of this unknown aspect of efficacy?
We did not do an early scan. At the time, had a lot of expertise in use of pembrolizumab and didn't really want to get a scan before like 2 months because the concern was you would get this sort of pseudo-progression effect. So we did not get early scans necessarily. Also, although there has subsequently been some concern about this idea of hyperprogression, that was not a thing when we launched the study. The sort of concerns about that came up after we started the study.
You know, you're recruiting one patient a month. It's all in a single center, so good. All of that experience is kind of concentrated, which is good. I mean, it would have been worse in a multi-site center. But when did you realize that this was not the right approach?
It is very easy. We had one excellent responder who was doing very well. And there were other people who progressed quickly, but that was what we anticipated.
Yep.
There were two clear events that came nearly simultaneously. One was that our hypothesis going into the study was that we would have no problem just salvaging all of these patients with an EGFR inhibitor after the pembrolizumab. And unfortunately, we did have one patient who developed severe pneumonitis and in fact passed away. That was paired with somewhat bizarre, but the people notified that the one patient who was having a great response, the laboratory recognized that they had erred in the original EGFR mutation call.
Oh, so the patient bonda.
So the responder, in fact, did not have an EGFR mutation.
When?
And so the laboratory had gone through for, and I won't get too much into the details, but they ended up going, not because of our study, but they ended up undergoing like a forensic type evaluation to evaluate the specimen and were able to definitively determine that their original EGFR mutation call was erroneous. And at that point, we had no responders on our study. I think after 11 patients, the one person who had this toxicity, which was now starting to be recognized as a potential problem because there was also around that time a study of durvalumab and osimertinib that showed a high rate of interstitial lung disease.
Yeah.
And with that, we decided to close the study.
And when you did try and salvage people with a TKI, was there excess toxicity with the pembro still on board?
So the numbers were so small, it's a little hard to make definitive determinations, but one death is obviously concerning enough. And it was not the only toxicity seen during the EGFR TKI period.
Okay. I mean, I totally agree with your point that a well-conducted negative study is incredibly important because, you know, we get your hands burned and you will learn from that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to be on a plenary session somewhere with a negative study, but it is actually really important. And I think it shows good drug development to say we answered the question, just wasn't the answer we wanted.
Correct. And so in the end, when it was done with 11 patients, we knew what we saw. It was the wrong answer. The hypothesis was disproved.
So let's talk a little bit about some of your greatest hits. So there's this guy who wants to be a scientist, but yet somehow he's becoming this well-known person in clinical trials. And I think the first time you really, you know, stood in the kind of plenary session was when you were the leader and the first author of the REVEL study. So, okay, so here we are, you know, we're going back in the time machine. We're little baby oncologists. How do you get to be leading a phase three?
We submitted that. One of the nice things about it, we had the data very shortly before ASCO, and Lancet has a rapid turnaround program where if you can show them that you have a randomized phase three study, then they promise you that they'll be able to sort of get it out within a month.
Well, let's back up. We better explain to people what the REVEL study is.
So the REVEL study is a study of docetaxel versus docetaxel and ramucirumab. Ramucirumab is a monoclonal antibody directed against this VEGF receptor. And in some ways, it was not the sexiest study of its time. Pairing anything with docetaxel could be described that way. And at this point, we knew that an anti-angiogenic in this setting was not going to revolutionize the care of these patients. So docetaxel is, again, a difficult therapy. We knew that an antiangiogenic was not going to radically alter what happened, but there was the potential that it would be an effective approach. Interestingly, one of the things that I think may have been important to the time is that based on, I had been involved with several Eli Lilly studies up until that point. We'd enrolled a lot of patients, but hadn't really gotten a lot of academic credits for it, which I only was two, but I, you know, sort of talked to them about, you know, sort of opportunities.
One other thing, though, that I think was very helpful was that there was a big sort of, I think, compliance issue.
And this is something that goes up and down over time. When we were originally training, the language from ASCO about what you were allowed to accept from pharma was, I thought, to be honest, just sort of awful. What it basically said was that if you had some special expertise, you could take as much payment as you wanted. But if not, if you took payment, you wouldn't be able to publish in JCL or present at ASCO.
Oh, really?
Because at that point, you would have been considered special, but I wasn't sure what that. And I was pretty aware of that. And so I, at that point in my career, was not taking any payment from pharma. And Eli Lilly had some of the major drugs of the time, you know, gemcitabine, pemetrexed.
Yep.
And so it was clear that that was an issue that was important to them, that for some reason my compliance. So I think the fact that I had enrolled on a lot of research hadn't necessarily done particularly well. It wasn't their marquee, most exciting study.
Yeah.
And that they would be able to have someone who they did not have any financial conflict with them, I think were all helpful factors.
So they approached you saying, we have this phase three or and we want you to enroll, or they said, we want you to design it. I mean, how did you get in?
No, I was involved. They came to me initially on that one with the idea that they were going to set up someone to be the national PI. There'd be one person PI in the U.S. and then one person outside the U.S. And that would I be willing to do one of those roles. But again, as you point out, it's not out of the blue. I'd been involved in...
You got it, put in your time.
Yeah, and in fact, the reality was that we enrolled particularly well on the Point Break study, which was the sexy study of the time. Now, we'll won't sound to that to trainees today.
Well, what was the Point Break study? It has a sexy title, by the way.
That's important, right? It must make it better. At the time, the exciting new drugs were bevacizumab and pemetrexed. They were, and so there was an approval for pemetrexed-based therapies and the program for bevacizumab along with paclitaxel, along with carboplatin. And this study was comparing carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab to carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab.
Okay.
It was a big deal at the time, largely because it was felt like it would be so expensive.
Yeah.
Because the bevacizumab and the pemetrexed were both under patent and it would be very expensive. And so we enrolled very well on that, but they already had all sorts of people who were leading. And so I think...
Was that Josie Vattel was leading that one?
Yes. So this was, in some ways, a consolation, is probably for the fact that we were doing very well on the marquee study.
Yeah.
And it sort of solved a problem for them. They were able to, probably a few problems for them. One, they were able to reward me with a, maybe they're not actual premier study.
Yeah.
They were able to have someone leading one of their studies who at the time was important to them, but that they were not receiving anything financially from them. And so I think those things all coalesced.
So can you explain what leading a study means in this context?
Sure. So leading a study is actually very interesting. Very interesting in part because there are so few important decisions that you make,
yeah,
but they're so important. I think that in any design questions they have, you're partly responsible. They don't ask you every single thing, as you can imagine. There are specific areas about the design. In this case, you know, the sorts of questions you would have are, you know, do you include squames?
Yeah.
You know, that's a, you know, sort of question. They're also interpretation, because there's data that always comes out from competitor studies for the conduct of the study. And so the question is, do you want to alter the conduct of your study? Do you want to alter the analysis of your study? And those are the sorts of questions that come up. And in this case, there's me and Bruce Poole, an excellent investigator out of France, and the people who were internal to Eli Lilly. And again, I don't like to overstate it. It wasn't like we had, you know, 800 questions. Yeah. We had a very small number of questions, but they were important and there were opportunities to make bad decisions. And fortunately, on that one, we, you know, we didn't make bad decisions.
Yeah. So, well, my experience is across a wide range. I've had ones like yours where I feel like I'm a member of the team and I'm helping to design it and, you know, and I'm the point of contact as things go on. So you're the kind of the Renton expert that sort of goes along with the drug team and you're sort of on the same side of the fence. But I've also had experiences where Big Pharma makes every decision and you're just this figurehead. You're like a sock puppet that they sort of, you know, wheel out and tell you what to say, which I really hate.
Right. Yeah, no, some of them, it's like, you know, when like a toddler is like, you thinks they're driving a car.
Yeah.
Like the Utopia ride at Disney, but there's really just a metal pole on.
So I was thinking of the ones in like the shopping mall where your mom is pushing the trolley and you're in the thing at the front trying to pretending you're steering it. That's a great analogy for some phase three study.
Yeah. And so this one was, I would say, somewhere in between in that, you know, we weren't making every decision, but there were a few decisions along the way that were important. They did pull us in, which was nice.
And then what about, you know, there's you and Maurice Perrault. So, I mean, Maurice was more senior in his career. Was there any discussion about who goes first, who goes senior in the authorship?
Yeah, and that actually went very, very easily. And that was very nice. The two of us were each sort of equal leads, and they sort of let us discuss it a little bit. And there were going to be two big things. One was a presentation at ASCO, and the other was doing the lead on the manuscript. And we just decided one would be first for one and we'd swap on the other. So he gave the presentation at ASCO and did a tremendous job. And then I was the senior author on that. And then I was the first author on the paper and he was the senior author on that. And it kind of worked out very nicely for both of us.
Do you remember how you first heard it was a positive study?
Oh, absolutely. So, and in fact, it was a very funny thing. And I sometimes joke about it. It was like a holiday weekend. We were away and I got a text from the person at Lilly who was the lead of the study. It was probably like the Saturday of a holiday weekend or something. He said, "Can we talk?" And I said, "Sure, I'm available now." He says, "No, after markets close on Tuesday, because we're having the holiday."
Yeah.
Weekend. I'm like, okay. And so I realized that obviously my dad's a corporate attorney.
Okay.
And so I realized they're going to have this, and we all know that the readout's coming. And so I assume that they, to protect everyone, they want to let you know the results, but wait until after the markets close on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And so,
in case you do insider trading,
it's to make sure that there's no possibilities.
Okay.
Anyway, we get to like after markets close, I first scheduled the call as soon as markets closed on that Tuesday. And there's a guy I've gone out for beers with many times. And so I call him, you know, all excited to hear about what the study is. And he picks up the phone. He says, "Hello, this is so-and-so. This is a courtesy call to inform you that there will be a press release regarding the results of the REBEL study tomorrow morning. Do you have any questions?" So obviously, like reading on the script, the answer has to be no. So first thing in the morning, I'm in my robe, you know, drinking my coffee, you know, refreshing on Google, looking for the outcome. And that eventually, after about 10 minutes after the markets opened, my Google search, you know, came up that the study was positive.
But when did you then know the details of how positive it was?
After the press release, a few days afterwards, we went over the actual results of the study.
So the REBEL study, which showed that adding ramucirumab into docetaxel was better than docetaxel alone, is always puzzled me because you've explained this to me before and I still don't understand, but it's a positive study, yet why isn't docetaxel ramucirumab the control arm in every second line study now? Why did they still allow docetaxel?
So I think there are a few issues. One is that because there is a population of patients that are not eligible for ramucirumab, that wouldn't be eligible for docetaxel ramucirumab, it is considered that you can run a standard of care, but you can run a study versus that doesn't require that.
Like whom? I mean, who we?
Central lesion.
Okay.
They were concerned about hemoptysis, for instance, that you could exclude them. interestingly, from a regulatory perspective, it actually splits based on what your endpoint is. And I believe this is still true. So if you are running a longitudinal study, you can run it against single agent docetaxel. But if you're looking for accelerated approval based on a single arm study, for instance, then the fact that there was a 23% response rate in REVEL makes that the standard. So you can't say, oh, we need historical data for single agent docetaxel, so our drug should be approved based on the single agent data. You need to, for that, use the data from REVEL. That ends up being part of it. But obviously, pharma likes not to use that as the control because it does add. Obviously, you'd rather have your comparator arm be the weakest it can be. We were just joking before we came in. We just heard a presentation here at World Lung where they're going to run a phase 3 study of a new ALK inhibitor versus Crizot.
Yeah.
That you couldn't do in the U.S. There are parts of the world you can do it, but obviously the results are interpreted with that. And I think that does happen if it is a problem, right? So the fact that sotorasib, for instance, and you can question how it would have compared to docetaxel and emicizumab, in terms of what people's perception of the efficacy of the drug is.
But can you think of a single phase 3 study since REVEL that has used docetaxel and emicizumab as a control arm? Because I can't.
No. Well, the only one is that this study of remicimab plus pembrolizumab. So many of the patients on that cooperative group study, the SWOG study, did get docetaxel remicimab.
It's like everyone gets that in the control arm, or it's a kind of dealer's choice, and it's one of the dealer's choice of this.
So we don't have that study open, but I think that it certainly isn't at least that a significant percentage of the people will get it. And I think that the majority got it in the original SWOG study.
Obviously, we've already talked about the REVEL study, which you're, I think, very well known for, but it's not the only sort of practice-changing, you know, big study, in fact, one that actually did get in the New England Journal of Medicine. So that first big study with pembrolizumab, was your experience similar or different?
That study was very different because whereas I went into the REVEL study as the national PI, the pembrolizumab study was a very different experience. So it was probably spring of 2012. My colleague Tony Rebus came to me and he had this drug, MK-3475, he was working with. He asked, would you be interested in taking, it's looking great in melanoma, would you be interested in opening a cohort in lung cancer?
Yeah.
The study was, I believe, originally 35-patient dose escalation study with a 15-patient expansion into melanoma. They had already expanded largely into melanoma, and we took on an expansion into lung. They were going to look at, 32 patients. It ended up being, 35. But we were put the very first people on that study in the lung cohort. And then we put 12 patients on that original cohort. And of that, we had, 3 responders who did extraordinarily well. To put 12 patients on the study over, a 4-month period nearly wrecked our study team. So then we had a period of time where we knew that this was going to open another cohort. And so we really staffed up and I built a team largely just to run this study, which is not an easy study to run. Everybody needed to get a biopsy beforehand, meaning the result of that. And so we basically built our whole team around being able to enroll as many people on this as possible. We ended up enrolling at UCLA nearly 100 patients on that study.
Wow.
So that was not a situation where I had any particular involvement from the start, but just on a practical level, we enrolled such a huge number of the patients. And, they eventually expanded to a huge number of sites. Probably at the point there were 200 patients, we probably would have had over a quarter of all the patients. At some points, probably closer to a third. And so that was a really fun experience because obviously we were sort of making things up as we went, and it was a very fluid study.
So that's one where you kind of really earned your leadership role there.
Right.
Not to imply you didn't earn it before, but in a different way.
And the other was sort of deferred from the prior things. In this case, we had all the patients. Obviously not all. It was 550 lung cancer patients. We had just under 20% of that. But that's, a very large study. That was a huge job.
And that was the first study that really started to define tumor proportion score as relevant and impacting outcome?
Correct. That led to the first approval of a biomarker for immunotherapy.
Yeah.
So that's correct. And then was that your first New England Journal of Medicine paper?
Yeah.
And what was the experience like? Were you involved in the submission? It's a very unique and slightly frou-frou, you know, submission process.
From my perspective, it was a fascinating experience, and it's a unique one. I mean, they have ability to get disclosure that they have, that they can say, we need this data to be included in the paper at the New England Journal. And the answer may initially come back no, but then you can say, well, that's fine. Then
you won't have a New England Journal
paper. Yeah, exactly.
It is a unique experience, and I would definitely agree with that. And on a study like that, I'm sure your experience is the same. You become very possessive of it.
You want to write every aspect. If I'm going down on this one, it's because of me.
Yeah.
Because I didn't do it right. I'm not going to fail because, you know, a medical writer somewhere, you know, didn't phrase it the right way. If it's not phrased the right way, it's going to be because I didn't.
It felt a little bit like going to the Wizard of Oz and, you know, asking for, you know, some, yeah, I'd like my heart or my brain or whatever. And he's going, boom, you know, you must send more data on this.
Right.
They do have a real power to get data, but they use it wisely, I think. I was very impressed with that experience.
I mean, I feel we could talk for a long time. One of the things I've always appreciated about you is your honesty and your kind of intellectual curiosity and, you know, the need to keep pushing things forward. But as we think about where you've come from and where you are now, you know, what are the next 5 years going to hold for you as an expert and also for you on a personal level?
I think for me, you know, the thing that's fun to me about this now is I get to sort of ask the questions I want. And if I'm not that excited about a question, I don't need to devote a lot of energy or effort to it. So for instance, over the last, you know, few years, once the pembrolizumab data, you know, was going through, people came to me all the time, we want to combine our drug with pembrolizumab, or whatever, how do we do that? And I got pretty discouraged that, you know, this idea that you should just empirically add anything to drugs was going to be an effective approach. So for that, I sort of went back sort of more towards sort of the scientist role. I got an R01 from NIH and now have a second one on that. I'm looking at questions about biomarkers, and that's been fun.
Did you have to set up a wet lab from scratch?
I don't have
more
of a dry lab, what I describe it as, with, you know, a lot of research assistants, a lot of trainees. And so, yeah, but everything's been built ground up. And, you know, as new interesting questions emerge, we can do them. We just had a paper in Nature that was in a field I've never published in before, looking at equity in clinical trial enrollment.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just a question that was interesting to me. I thought we had the data, we could answer it, and we did it. And that was fun. I think over the next several years, I obviously want to work on the things I proposed as part of the R01, but I'm also really excited about mentoring other people. You know, I feel very fortunate with the thing that I've been able to do recently. Aaron Lisberg, who trained under me, he has a K Award, a Career Development Award from NIH, is starting to write R01s. I have 3 people I'm writing letters for right now who are going through grant submissions, and those people are smart. They actually are well positioned to move things forward, and I'm excited about that. So I think I'm really hopeful that I can continue to sort of assess what are the questions that I can answer and work on doing that, and working on also building the careers of those around me. That's been actually something really exciting. To the original Pembro study of my research assistants who helped us succeed, we've now had over 20 of them go on to medical school.
Wow.
So they worked for me for a couple of years, they work hard, and then they achieve their career goals.
And you haven't put them off medicine.
Right, yeah.
I haven't convinced them away from it.
Eddie, thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much. This has been great.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onclive On Air.